this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the headline across the top of the page, RIM expands here in torrid product race. Now, this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Cary, and the article runs horizontally across the top of the page. On the far left, there's a picture of a BlackBerry on one side of the article. Then on the other side of the article, there's a picture of a building, the outside of a building, with the caption, one of the center green buildings occupied by RIM in Cary. Research in Motion is steadily expanding its software and hardware development center in Cary as the BlackBerry smartphone maker refines new products, including the Playbook tablet computer, which debuts April 19. The company now occupies 78,000 square feet of space in three buildings in Cary and in Durham, according to a March 29 securities filing. That is about 50% more space than RIM contracted to lease last fall. It's enough office space to accommodate more than 200 software developers, engineers, and personnel. RIM officials have not disclosed how many jobs they've created in the Triangle since acknowledging reports in January 2010 that the company planned to open an R&D office in the Triangle. But the company keeps a steady stream of job listings on its career website for positions in the Triangle, mostly for software developers and system engineers. RIM spokeswoman Jamie Ernst stated on March 30 that company officials were unavailable to comment. The company employs about 17,500 people around the world. Ontario-based RIM lists office locations in two buildings at Cary's Center Green Business Park and on two floors of an office building at 2530 Meridian Parkway in Durham. They came in very quietly and we weren't really engaged, says Ken Atkins, executive director of Wake County Economic Development, which works with companies interested in relocating to or expanding in the county. To date, RIM has requested no incentives from Cary or from Wake County. Research in Motion, led by co-CEOs Jim Balsillie and Mike Lazaridis, has been riding a wave of popularity around its BlackBerry mobile phones since introducing the line in 1999. But growth in its lineup has been waning as the BlackBerry platform becomes increasingly outdated. It has lagged behind Apple's iPhone and Google's Android system in developing touchscreen technology and applications to drive software sales. There are about 25,000 apps available for BlackBerry phones compared to 400,000 apps for Apple and 260,000 apps for Android. RIM for years was the market share leader in the smartphone space, but recently lost that position to the Google Android operating system, according to research from ComScore. As of August 2010, RIM's BlackBerry held a U.S. share of 37.6%, while Android had a 19.6% share in August. By January, Android had stormed ahead with 31.2% of the market, compared to BlackBerry's 30.4%. The most frequent question we get from investors on RIM these days is whether we think the company can regain its leadership position in the eyes of end users, developers, and investors, wrote RIM analyst Shaw Wu of Stern Agee in a recent report. Our simple answer is it will be tough, but not impossible. RIM is set to launch sales of its Playbook tablet in April as a head-to-head competitor with Apple's iPad and an increasing number of others. Playbook will be the first tablet to support Flash, a multimedia technology developed by Adobe to add animation, video, and interactivity to web pages. It's a challenging period for a company that once had no peer in the smartphone base. Balsillie acknowledged as much in a March 24 conference call with analysts. It's a time of enormous investment and transition, he said. We believe we have an architecture and a platform that future-proofs the company. And our next article, still on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, is in the center of the page, has a black border around it. Inside that border at the top, there's a picture of surgery, of a surgeon in an operating room performing a surgery. The caption reads, "Health professionals perform a medical procedure at Wake Med in Raleigh." And then under that, on the left side, is the headline in bold black lettering, NC faces gap of $2.5 billion due to end of stimulus. program helped states with Medicaid expenses. And then on the right is the article. And this one is written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. Since 2008, North Carolina has benefited from an additional $2.5 billion in federal Medicaid stimulus reimbursements. With the stimulus money going away, the state is left to pick up a larger portion of Medicaid TAB that could top $13 billion in the coming year. How state lawmakers plan to pay for this is anyone's guess. That's the $3 billion question, says Chris Mackey, a spokeswoman for Governor Beverly Perdue. As part of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act passed in 2008, North Carolina received an enhanced federal medical assistance percentage, or FMAP, rate. That's the rate at which the federal government matches what states pay in Medicaid bills. For example, the state in fiscal year 2009 through 2010 normally would have gotten 65.1% of its Medicaid payments matched. With a stimulus extension, 78% were matched. With the rate stepping down on April 1 and reverting back to the standard rate on July 1, the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Safety is asking hospitals to submit Medicaid bills as quickly as possible. That way, the state can pay those bills and apply for a reimbursement at the higher rate. After those cutoff dates, however, the state has to make up the difference. It's certainly a large concern, says Republican State Senator Stan Bingham, who is co-chairman of the state health care committee. Bingham did not offer specific ideas on making up the difference because the Senate is still in preliminary budget talks, but he says the budget gap is of grave concern to him. Under the FMAP's highest reimbursement rate to North Carolina, October 2009 through December 2010, the state received an additional $1 billion in Medicaid reimbursements over what it typically would have gotten. All told, the state will have received more than $2.5 billion for a three-year period ending June 30, estimates the DHHS. Traditionally, the federal government has paid roughly 65% of the state's Medicaid bills, or about $2 out of every $3. In 2010, the stimulus program kicked in an additional 10%, kicking up that ratio to 3-1. Put another way, the federal government covered 75% of the state's Medicaid bills, or $3 out of every $4 spent. On April 1, the reimbursement rate declined from 72.2% to 70.3%, leaving the state to cover an extra 2% of Medicaid bills. That might not seem like a lot, but when it's considered that total Medicaid spending in North Carolina this year will be $12.9 billion, it's a lot. At the height of stimulus funding, from October 1, 2010 through December 31, 2010, the state received a match of 75%. On July 1, the rate will drop to the pre-stimulus rate of roughly 65%, or the usual 2-1 match. While the state is asking for Medicaid bills as soon as possible, financial directors at hospitals say they can't really go much faster. Quite honestly, it's just our policy to get our bills out as quickly as possible anyway, said Jack Dennis, WakeMed Health and Hospitals Director of Revenue. As for what will happen when the additional federal stimulus Medicaid money dries up, Dennis declined to give any opinion. What goes on with Medicaid is always a concern, he said, but would not comment further about any potential decrease in funding. Karen McCall, UNC Healthcare's Vice President of Public Affairs and Marketing, echoed the thoughts from WakeMed and added that it's typically only a matter of days to send the bill to DHHS. We can usually turn the bill around fairly quickly, she said. And moving just to the right of that article, our next article, also written by Jason DeBrun, this one with the Dateline of Chapel Hill, the headline, UNC in lead of 21-year project. Now, this article runs vertically along the right side of the page. Underneath the article, there's a picture of two women in an office with a small child. The caption reads, Anna Marie Sega-Riz of UNC works with a child at the Carolina Population Center. The Carolina Population Center at UNC Chapel Hill is heading up the North Carolina component of a national health study to track children from before they're born until they blow out 21 candles. The research is part of the National Children's Study, a 21-year effort to track more than 100,000 adolescents through 30 study sites across the country. More than $626 million in federal money already has been spent funding the study, and depending on the mood of Congress, that figure could grow. So far, the Carolina Population Center has received $64.9 million in a five-year contract for a first phase of studies in Duplin and Durham counties. The center wants to track at least 5,000 adolescents through the years. Anna Marie Siga-Riz, a professor of epidemiology and nutrition at the UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health, says she doesn't know how much future funding might be coming, saying, "It depends on congressional appropriations." Unlike most research projects, which are typically funded through grants, appropriations for the National Children's Study are part of the Children's Health Law and awarded on a contract basis directly from Congress. "We would only hope that this funding would continue to support the full 21 years of the study," says Siga-Riz. Researchers want to learn how a child's environment can affect his or her health and development. For the study, environment involves a variety of factors, including air, water, house, dust, diet, care provided, safety of a neighborhood, doctor visits, etc., according to a report. "It's a study that's really important in terms of learning about child health," says Dr. Emmanuel Chip Walter, a pediatrician with Duke Health and a co-principal investigator with the study. "My interest in this study is really geared toward what keeps children healthy and what is harmful to children's health. It potentially answers some of the questions that I deal with on a day-to-day basis that I don't really have answers for." How environment affects health is obvious in some cases. Eating sugars and playing video games likely will lead to childhood obesity, for example, but other factors still lie uncharted. Walter says there have been hundreds of new chemicals developed in the past two decades for which scientists do not know the full impact on health, particularly children's health. The study could provide answers. Siga-Riz works as a co-principal investigator alongside Walter, the director of the Duke Vaccine and Infectious Diseases Epidemiology Unit. The project manager for the study is Sharon Loza. "It's a unique opportunity," Walter says. "Too many studies follow children for a short period of time, but they really don't follow children for their lifetime." Also involved are researchers from the Battelle Institute, a global nonprofit research and development organization. Battelle is mainly involved in data collection on a subcontract basis with the Population Center. Its portion of the contract comes to $7.9 million, says Charles Knott, the principal investigator for Battelle. Studies in Durham and Duplin counties are meant as a precursor to more robust future studies. They will serve somewhat as trial runs for researchers to figure out the best way to conduct their work. The counties are among 105 individual counties or groups of counties in the country that will be studied. In choosing the areas, researchers wanted to include people from different ethnic, racial, economic, religious, geographic, and social groups, according to a report. Durham County offers one of the most diverse populations in North Carolina. Durham County has a higher percentage than the state average of every racial minority group except American Indian, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Once the studies are up and running in Durham and Duplin counties, the research will be expanded to include Burke, Cumberland, and Rockingham counties in North Carolina. And our last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal runs horizontally across the bottom of the page. The headline: draft bill would dissolve Golden Leaf, divert millions to state. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the dateline of Raleigh. And on the far left side, there's a picture of a man in a suit and tie standing outside of a federal building downtown Raleigh. And the caption reads, "Golden Leaf President Dan Gerlach opposes move." Having dodged one legislative bullet, the Rocky Mount-based Golden Leaf Foundation once again finds itself in crosshairs on Jones Street. Two Republican House members, Paul Stamm of Wake County and Greg Horn of Union County, are drumming up support for a plan to dissolve the 11-year-old economic development nonprofit and transfer its $640 million-plus endowment to the state pension system. Also under the plan, Golden Leaf's 50% annual share of the millions flowing annually into North Carolina from the National Tobacco Settlement would be split up for other purposes. Portions of that money would go for equipment purchases at community colleges and economic development programs run out of the Department of Commerce, and to compensate people sterilized under a long-defunct state eugenics program. Stamm and Horn are lobbying for support among House leaders and others and have incorporated their ideas into draft legislation, which has yet to be introduced. "We want to do our homework and talk to as many people as we can," says Horn. "This has been the subject of a long debate, as you well know." Stamm recently outlined the plan in a speech to the North Carolina Economic Developers Association, NCEDA. "This idea is different from what you have seen in the past," he told the group. "Your initial concern is understandable, but if you will look carefully at our proposal, you will see that this approach will deliver more funding more quickly for economic development initiatives than is true at present." Golden Leaf is lobbying hard against it. "On the record, we oppose the draft legislation," says Golden Leaf President Dan Gerlach, adding that the proposal has more to do with budget balancing than economic development. Transferring the agency's endowment to the pension fund, he says, moreover, would mean that Golden Leaf investment earnings would no longer be available to make development grants. The Stamm Horn proposal marks the second time during the current session that lawmakers trying to overcome a large budget gap have looked at Golden Leaf. In an earlier move passed by the General Assembly, but vetoed by Governor Beverly Perdue, budget writers attempted to divert the agency's next tobacco payment of nearly $68 million into the state's general fund to help fill the $2 billion plus revenue hole. Golden Leaf was set up by the General Assembly in 1999 and given the mission of helping once tobacco-dependent rural communities in the state diversify their economic bases. Since its inception, the agency has awarded grants totaling $707 million, some $242 million of that using investment earnings generated by the Golden Leaf Endowment. In a response to a query earlier this year, Gerlach said Golden Leaf has created or saved 33,101 jobs through its grants. North Carolina Commerce Secretary Keith Crisco has weighed in on the idea of scrapping Golden Leaf, saying in a letter that Golden Leaf is crucial to our ongoing recruitment efforts, workforce development, and community preparedness activities across the state. For Stamm, Horn, and others in the General Assembly, however, North Carolina should be considering a different approach to economic development. The idea of abolishing Golden Leaf, Stamm said in his remarks to the NCEDA, came from an informal panel of economic development experts consulted by House leaders. This same panel, he says, believes the state could get more of a bang for its development dollars by funding industrial parks, multi-jurisdictional industrial parks, brownfield remediations, shell buildings, and community college training programs. NCEDA President Jimmy Smith says his group wanted to air both sides of the debates over Golden Leaf and the direction of the state's overall economic development policy, but didn't endorse either side of the issue. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off: Builders Default, Bank Takes Over Raleigh Center. And right under that, there's a picture, the outside of a large building. The caption reads, "Gateway has offices in building on which it foreclosed." Gateway Bank and Trust has foreclosed on the marketplace at Lake Boone Trail after developers of the three-building project defaulted on a $9 million loan. Marketplace, where Gateway has its regional headquarters, had been part of a joint venture with Access Medical Development of Raleigh and Oaks Development of Cary. Both of those companies have had trouble in recent years keeping up with mortgage payments for properties across the triangle. Marketplace's retail space was 54% occupied and the office space 30% occupied in the fourth quarter. People who talk about the good old days sometimes don't remember that they weren't so good for some folks. Take the early 1900s when children were sent to work in North Carolina textile mills, laboring 10 to 12 hours, 6 days a week in hot, humid, lint-filled factories. In 1908, the National Child Labor Committee hired photographer Lewis Hine to document these horrid working conditions and the kids who essentially had no childhood time to play and learn. A collection of Hines' images now are on display at the North Carolina Museum of History in downtown Raleigh. The photos are haunting, showing children who looked much older than their ages, some covered with lint after long hours in the spinning rooms. It was the National Child Labor Committee, relying heavily on these photographs, that led to enforcement of existing child labor laws, which largely were ignored at the time. Besides the photos, Heinroth often wrote notes to accompany them. One quotes an impoverished young boy saying, "Been in mill 6 or 7 years, 12 years old, hain't grown none for 5 years." The exhibit will be on view through March 25, 2012, and admission is free. Don't miss it. Biz thinks it's about time we give all the business owners and C-level executives in the area a test. Answers at the end. Here's the first question. In 2010, what publicly traded Raleigh company managed to renew 99 out of every 100 customers it had at the end of 2009? Second question. Among companies that renewed their business with this company, what was the average renewal value? If you said 120%, you'd be correct. And the winner is Raleigh open source software firm Red Hat. Regarding the high business retention rates, Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst had this comment: "This clearly demonstrates the value our largest customers see in relationship with Red Hat." Clearly, Jim. Canadian rubber products manufacturer AirBoss of America Corporation is opening a sales and technical service center in Wake Forest with a staff of 7. AirBoss in 2005 opened a 102,000-square-foot rubber compounding manufacturing facility in Halifax County that employs 56 people. Plant manager Britt Ledford says the Wake Forest Center will serve all of the company's customers in the U.S. According to a recent job posting, AirBoss is seeking chemists and national account managers who can provide field support for the company's new product development group accounts. AirBoss was awarded a 1NC incentive grant in 2005 to open the Scotland Neck plant, but it claimed only $37,500 of the $150,000 granted, according to Department of Commerce documents, because the company never reached the 86-job threshold it had promised. A global commodities company called Faux Intertrade is on the hunt for space in downtown Raleigh, where it can move its private equity business. Tonight Brown, managing director of Faux's Real Estate Buildings, and I should spell that, it's F-A-U-V-E, so I'm not sure if that's a, we'll say Faux, says the company is seeking 3,000 to 8,000 square feet to allow for expansion. Brown says Faux's executive director, Justin Bonaparte, is in negotiations to sublease space in the RBC Plaza Tower, but no deal has been finalized, and the company is considering other locations in downtown Raleigh. Faux's headquarters is currently in the Forum Office Park in North Raleigh. It hopes to relocate its staff of 20 to 30 people this summer. The company was founded in 2004 by Oscar C. Fields. NC State University soon will hire a new basketball coach who will be tasked with returning the program to its glory days. And if you're a diehard Wolfpacker who wants to revel in those memories from long ago, because let's face it, there haven't been too many good hoops memories lately, you'll get your chance April 5. That's the night of the Greater Raleigh Sports Council's Evening of Champions, which celebrates local athletes, both professionals and amateurs. This year's speaker is none other than David Thompson, the legendary college star who led NCSU to a national championship in 1974. The event will be held at the Embassy Suites in Cary from 6 to 9 p.m. The year 2009 was a very bad year for 1.6 million North Carolinians. Feeding America, a nonprofit hunger relief organization, estimates that that population, nearly 1 in 5, struggled with limited or uncertain access to food that year, the height of the recession. Action for Children North Carolina disseminated the report. Here's how it breaks down in the triangle. In Wake County, 118,680 people, or 14.3% of the population, struggled with getting enough nutritious food. Durham County, 42,840 people, or 16.7%. Orange County, 18,350, or 14.7%. Johnston County, 26,650, or 17%. Coming soon is the 6th annual Handmade Market, a one-day event in Raleigh that features works of artists, crafters, and designers. This year, the event will be April 23, a Saturday, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Cobblestone Hall in downtown City Market. The event includes a fundraiser to benefit Toxic Free NC, a local nonprofit with the mission of eradicating pesticide pollution in our water, our food, and our bodies through education, governmental influence, and community knowledge. North Carolina State University will host the 16th annual Dog Day Fun Run Sunday, April 3, with proceeds supporting the Wake County Animal Shelter. The event features a 5K cross-country run at noon and a 2-mile walk at 1:30 p.m. for people and their dogs. In the 5K run, the first male and female runners will receive gift certificates, and there will be prizes for the top male and female runners under age 18. A veterinarian will be available throughout the day, but participants are advised to check with their own vet if their dog is not accustomed to running a 5K or walking 2 miles. Dogs must be on a leash at all times and have a current inoculation. Entry fees are $25 for the 5K run and $15 for the 2-mile walk. Late entrants can register beginning at 11 a.m. on race day. The run is sponsored by NC State College of Veterinary Medicine's student chapter of the American Veterinary Medical Association, and sanctioned by Run NC. The attorneys and paralegals at Clifton & Singer, a Raleigh firm with a strong concentration in residential real estate, are joining up with Ragsdale Leggett. Clifton & Singer has just 2 attorneys, but employs 11 paralegals. The move comes not long after the death of name partner Richard Singer in September. Singer and Ben Clifton founded the firm back in 1978. Raleigh-based Ragsdale Leggett has 19 attorneys. FHI will host a summit on the future of global health and development on Friday, April 1. The meeting will feature representatives from USAID, CDC, CSIS, Harvard University, as well as local institutions including UNC Chapel Hill, Duke University, North Carolina State University, and RTI International. Based in Research Triangle Park, FHI is a global health and development organization that seeks to improve quality of life around the globe. The summit offers a platform to discuss state-of-the-art technologies, research findings, and key policy issues. The event was at the William and Ida Friday Center for Continuing Education at 100 Friday Center Drive in Chapel Hill. And contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Chris Basden, Monica Chen, and Jason DeBrun. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. This next article has a headline, Judge Scolds Lawyers for Their Stinky Fees. And this article is written by Chris Basden with the Dateline of Charlotte. In a ruling that should have cost-conscious shareholders cheering, a North Carolina business court judge has decried stinky fees that he says lawyers sometimes receive in class-action lawsuits filed in the wake of mergers involving public companies. The ruling by Judge Ben Tenniel came in a lawsuit called Ward v. Lance Incorporated, which was filed in regard to the recent $1.6 billion merger of Charlotte-based snack company Lance Incorporated and Pennsylvania-based Snyder's of Hanover Incorporated. Tenniel retired shortly after issuing the February 28 order, in which he approved a dismissal of the case due to settlement. Tenniel labels the money paid to counsel and plaintiff as stinky fees because they smell bad and lack justification. We have come to the point in this country that whenever a merger is announced, some lawyer with a client holding a small number of shares rushes to file a lawsuit containing class action allegations, Tenniel writes. After minimal discovery and review by an expert, plaintiff requests that additional information be disclosed and agrees to go away with settlement in hand, having done absolutely nothing for the class. The Ward v. Lance Incorporated case started out with class action allegations, but those were later dropped. Court documents filed late last year show that the settlement agreement included a payment of more than $93,000. That money went to pay the attorney's fees and expenses, as well as a financial expert retained by Albert A. Ward, Jr., the plaintiff. Of that settlement, $5,000 went to Ward. Asked about Tennille's order, UNC Chapel Hill law professor Thomas Lee Hazen says, "I would say that it is certainly more strongly worded than the normal opinion." Hazen adds that he's never heard the term stinky fees. While the label may be new, the judge's concerns aren't novel. Hazen says Tennille is addressing a topic that has drawn the attention of both federal courts and the U.S. Congress, lawyers filing a suit for their benefit, not the client's. Tennille also was critical of companies and their representatives who are willing to pay the fees in order to consummate a merger. "Defendants are, in effect, complicit in the economically valueless charade," Tennille writes. He also had some advice for his colleagues still on the bench. In the future, judges should decline to approve any settlement that does not benefit shareholders in a material way. Charlotte attorney Bruce Simpson helped represent the plaintiff in the case. Simpson said he was the local counsel for New York City-based Harwood Pfeffer and referred questions to Matt Houston, an attorney at that firm. Houston could not be reached for comment. K&L Gates attorney Chris Lamb, who helped represent Lance Incorporated in the case, declined to comment. In his order, Tennille briefly made reference to a separate Lance merger lawsuit that was filed in federal court. Plaintiff's lawyers in that case declined to discuss the business court ruling, but did give their perspective on why their work is important. While executives may not like these types of lawsuits, Boca Raton, Florida attorney Kenneth Vianel says that class action cases and mergers can lead to material disclosures. "The idea that they're all bad is not true," he says. Joe Gentile, a New York City plaintiff's attorney who also worked on the Lance federal court case, points out what he sees as the benefits of lawsuits that result in disclosures. "It's to the shareholders' benefit to vote when they have full information," he says. And our next article is in the center of the page on page 3 of the Triangle Business Journal. It has a black border around it. Inside that border, first at the top, there's a picture of at the port. The caption reads, "Some 6.7 million tons of cargo are handled at the Wilmington port." And it's showing the cargo being moved either on or off a ship. And then under that is the article, with a bold black headline, "Cutting back at the ports. NC's two shipping terminals stay conservative. Still, tonnage rises." And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. Still recovering from a double-digit revenue hit in 2009, North Carolina's two state-operated shipping ports are scaling back expansion plans, even as income and tonnage inch higher. The authority that runs the ports has scrapped plans to acquire a parcel of land at its Wilmington terminal to store lumber bound for shipping, and will also cut back on equipment purchases. That's on top of shelving a proposal to develop a $3 billion deep water port complex in Southport. To reflect a more conservative growth plan, managers have shaved $50 million out of the port's $220 million capital improvement program. Port spokeswoman Shannon Moody says the cutbacks may not be permanent. "They were made given the state of the economy," she says, "and we'll wait and see how business goes before making any decisions on them." New York-based Fitch Ratings applauds the austerity moves, calling them a sign of management's continued prudence, according to analyst Emma Griffin. Fitch went on to assign a BBB+ acceptable risk rating to $44 million in ports revenue bonds. The authority uses a mix of shipping revenue, bond income, and grants to complete capital projects at its two terminals in Wilmington and Morehead City. The recession year of 2009 saw revenue slump by 13% to $35 million at the two operations through which passed tons of wood pulp, chemicals, rubber, potash, general cargo, and containers. Fiscal 2010, which ended June 30, brought another 3.5% revenue decline to $33 million. But since then, the rays of sunlight began breaking through. The 7 months ending in January 2011 have marked the beginning of a turnaround. Operating revenue is ahead of where it was in the comparable periods in both 2009 and 2010. In fact, it was 12.9% ahead of where it was in 2010 and 1.13% over budgeted projections. Total tonnage is up by 11.6% behind an increased volume of container cargo at Wilmington and a rise in so-called break bulk cargo at both facilities. A break bulk refers to various kinds of goods packed in miscellaneous forms such as boxes, bales, or drums. Moreover, guaranteed or confirmed cargo provisions covered 1.5 million tons, representing nearly $2 million in obligated payments to the ports. Last year, those figures were 1.1 million tons worth $1.68 million. The cargo provisions represent 6% of ports' revenue. The ports, though operated by the state, are self-supporting. For the 12 months ending June 30, 2010, the ports' net assets were $221,000, down 2.6% from $227,000 in 2009, according to a fiscal 2010 audit. Fitch's rating analysts in their recent bond review remarked that the North Carolina port system remains one of the smaller facilities on the agency's radar screen. Rex Sherman of the Arlington, Virginia-based American Association of Ports Authorities ranks ports by total tonnage and other indicators. In 2009, according to Sherman, Wilmington, the larger of the two North Carolina facilities, ranked 61st out of 68 U.S. locations with a total tonnage of 6.72 million. Virginia ports are larger. Hampton Roads, 10th, 58 million tons, and Richmond, 28th, 25 million tons. So were facilities further south, including Charleston, 39th, 15.8 million tons, and Savannah, 21st, with 34.2 million. Retail, homes, hotel, plan for Chapel Hill. That's the headline on our next article. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the dateline of Chapel Hill. And above the article, there's also a map showing the project, showing it being near Weaver Dairy Road and MLK Jr. Boulevard. A Chapel Hill land developer intends to spend $50 million to build a mixed-use project featuring offices, retail, housing, and a hotel on 14 acres at the intersection of Weaver Dairy Road and Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Chapel Hill. Bill Christian, president of William Christian & Associates, bought the land in 2008 and has been developing his plan and biding his time for a comeback in the economy. He will formally present his plans for Charterwood at an April 11 public hearing before the Chapel Hill Town Council. Christian hopes the council will approve his zoning amendment and special use permit in May. Charterwood's plan incorporates a mix of 87 residential cottages, townhouses, and condo units, 55,000 square feet of commercial and retail space, a 100-room hotel, and enough parking for 282 vehicles, according to documents filed with town staff. It would be the first development project Christian has tackled since he helped build about 12 homes in the Cameron Glen community in Chapel Hill in the late 1980s, he says. Trained as a city planner, Christian has provided real estate consulting services, market analysis, and fiscal analysis for public and private clients across the Southeast for more than 30 years. He was a project manager for the Atlanta Regional Commission when it was putting together plans for that city's MARTA transit system. He consulted with the Sea Island Company of Georgia for more than 20 years, and he assisted developers of the 700-acre National Village Golf Course community in Auburn, Alabama, among other projects. I'm very into transit-oriented development, he says, pointing out that Chapel Hill bus lines run past the Charterwood property. Two shopping centers, two grocery stores, 10 movie theater screens, and more than a dozen restaurants are within a 10-minute walk of the site. Compared to Chapel Hill's newest mixed-use development, East 54, Christian says Charterwood will have only one-third the density as East 54's 427,000 square feet of offices, retail, residential condominiums, and hotel rooms, but he says it will be on about the same amount of acreage. When I saw this property come up for sale, I knew this was a good piece of property and a good location, he says. Christian says his investment partners in the property include several longtime friends who reside outside North Carolina, but he would not identify them. The Chapel Hill Planning Board voted 6-2 to recommend approval of Charterwood's zoning amendment and voted 5-3 to recommend approval of its special use permit, according to Chapel Hill Development Manager Gene Poveromo. Calvin Malott of Carborough, developer of the Northwoods 5 residential community that abuts Christian's Charterwood property, says he's neither in support nor against Christian's plans to develop the site. But he adds, getting approval from the Chapel Hill Town Council probably will be an uphill battle. Malott says he considered requesting permission to subdivide the remaining 1.18 acres in Northwoods 5 into four residential lots last fall, but several Chapel Hill Council members expressed concerns about the impact additional homes might have on a stream adjacent to the property. The town's requirements can be overwhelming if you're not careful, Malott warns. Having been through it, I know the pain. And our next article is written by Monica Chen with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Red Hat Execs Pushed Hard for Incentives. When Governor Beverly Perdue donned a red fedora on January 10 to join in an announcement that Red Hat was staying put in Raleigh, the celebratory mood was in stark contrast to the backroom high-stakes drama that led up to the big day. Documents released by the North Carolina Department of Commerce disclose an ongoing saga of negotiations in which Red Hat executives made it clear they wanted money in exchange for not relocating to another state. They played off other decisions by the state, claiming to be upset that tech companies based in California, namely Google and Apple, had gotten incentives in the form of North Carolina taxpayer money. They lobbied for a curriculum in open-source software, the company's core service, to be established at NC State University. In the end, they got most of what they wanted. With Perdue beaming, Red Hat executives announced that the company would create 540 jobs and invest $109 million in Wake County in return for $15 million in incentives over 12 years. Commerce Department files on the Red Hat recruitment reveal that news of Red Hat looking at other locations began percolating in early May 2010. Vivian Powell, manager for the Research Triangle region for the Commerce Department and head of Project Pyramid, as the Red Hat case was dubbed internally, dashed off an email to fellow staffers. Have either of you met with Red Hat regarding their potential expansion? After checking with Tom Rabin, Executive Vice President of Corporate Affairs at Red Hat, Powell held back on following up. The company did not seem to be looking to expand at that time. Over the following months, however, Red Hat did look at other locations to relocate its headquarters from Centennial Campus at NC State. By September, the process had been kicked off for negotiations with the state on incentives. Ken Atkins, Vice President of Economic Development at the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce, noted with some frustration the lack of communication from Red Hat in an email on September 15th. Like you, we were told not to contact the company and to wait until the right time to become involved, Atkins wrote. I learned yesterday that the company officials are visiting Boston, Austin, and Atlanta this week and that a decision will be made by Thanksgiving. In handwritten notes, Commerce staffers gripe that the state cannot compete with Georgia and Texas on taxes or on corporate payout. Stiff competition, they wrote. Staffers also noted that Red Hat was upset that money was given to Google and Apple to open operations in the state, and repeatedly noted that the company wanted North Carolina State to provide open source curriculum. Local governments step up. The state and the city of Raleigh marshaled support from the Office of Information Technology, the North Carolina Community College System, and Wake Technical Community College to offer Red Hat incentives to stay, including training and use of Red Hat software in government. At one point during negotiations, Red Hat noted that other states would provide incentives even if the jobs targets were not met, which is a requirement in North Carolina. An October 15 email from Stuart Dickinson, Director of Finance at Commerce, regarding a conversation with Red Hat consultant Anthony Copeland stated, "He called this AM with an operational question. His comment was that other states they are working with will give a partial payment even if the job target is not met, as well as providing an upside for additional grant funds if they exceed their targets." I explained why the JDIG, North Carolina Incentive Program, cannot do that with its fixed annual budget of $15 million. Dickinson added, he said his client is being very conservative in their approach to evaluating the incentive packages from the states where they are looking to potentially relocate. In the November 4 letter to officially start the process, Dale Carroll, Deputy Secretary and Chief Operating Officer of Commerce, outlined the following incentives for the company to locate in Wake or Durham County: $19.4 million in two phases for 650 jobs total, and $138 million in investment by Red Hat. The company, which was looking at locations in Georgia and Texas throughout the fall, did not decide to stay in North Carolina until December, and appears to not have decided between Wake and Durham, based on the documents released, until close to Christmas. High stakes poker. After some back and forth, including one instance in which the assistant to Crisco noted with a tinge of dismay that Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst's executive assistant could not give out his cell phone number even to the governor, all the players finally got together for a brunch at the governor's mansion on December 22 with the governor, Whitehurst, Don Hobart, a strategist and advisor to the governor, and Red Hat CFO Charlie Peters. Throughout the recruitment process, Raleigh officials were heavily looped into the commerce goings-on, but Durham officials sent their proposal separately to Copeland, the Red Hat consultant. Feels odd not sending it to you, Ted Connor, Vice President of Economic Development for the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce, told Powell. Brent Lane, Director of the Center for Competitive Economies at UNC Chapel Hill's Kenan Flagler Business School, likens the recruitment process to a poker game. In the case of Red Hat, company officials knew exactly what cards the state was holding, but state recruiters knew nothing of Red Hat's hand. Local governments, including Durham, were even further at a disadvantage. The stakes were high in the recruitment of Red Hat, a homegrown, public, high-profile company and one of the largest employers in the area. The company recently posted increases in revenue and profit for the fourth quarter and is close to becoming the first $1 billion annual revenue open-source software company. That makes the question of whether or not they needed to do this even more difficult to resolve, Lane says, of the hefty incentives. I can picture someone in Wake County saying at some point, we can't possibly lose this. By late December and early January, with the deal points done, Commerce staffers were busy putting together the final paperwork, mixing legal and financial numbers in their emails with friendly chatter about holiday plans. On January 7, the Friday before the announcement, Karen West, a general counsel at Commerce, announced that Project Pyramid was done. Red Hat has accepted the terms and committed to locate both projects in Wake County. Posen explores social media as sub for outside Salesforce. That's the headline on our next article. It's written by Monica Chen with a Dateline of Chapel Hill. After getting two of its products approved and marketed by Big Pharma, Posen Incorporated is now looking to social media to sell its PA franchise, a form of aspirin the company claims to be safer and with blockbuster potential. If the first of the PA drugs, PA-32540, receives regulatory approval in 2013 as the company hopes, Posen will eschew the traditional mode of having sales reps make calls on doctors and instead target websites such as Sermo, an exclusive physician social media network, to generate sales. The rep model is not working anymore, says Elizabeth Cernak, Chief Commercial Officer, Posen. We're watching everybody very closely to formulate what our commercial strategy will be. Social media will be a component of it. It will be very digitally based. Although the Chapel Hill boutique drug company has been tossing around social media options for a while, Cernak revealed at an investors' conference for the first time recently more details about the direction the company might be taking. By hiring contractors to do public relations and other marketing work, the company plans to keep a core group of reps, about 100 to 200, and 50 additional medical science liaisons, according to Cernak. The company estimates it can reach 220,000 doctors at $225 per doctor annually by using social media, compared to the traditional sales rep model of 44,000 doctors at $2,000 per doctor. And let's say a social media strategy for PA has a good chance of success, in part because the franchise's similarity to aspirin means a lower learning curve for physicians. Posen has already priced the PA drugs at $1 daily. I don't think that all products are able to employ such a strategy, says Robert Hazlett, an analyst with BMO Capital Markets. But given that the components of the PA family are pretty well known and the concept is pretty simple and straightforward, then we think Posen can have some success. The first product out of the PA family, PA32540, is a tablet of a proton pump inhibitor layered around a pH-sensitive aspirin. Posen recently announced positive results from Phase 1, showing that when given with clopidogrel, C-L-O-P-I-D-O-G-R-E-L, or Plavix, it produces improved anti-clotting than when replaced by aspirin. The PA family is intended to reduce gastrointestinal ulcers when compared to taking aspirin alone. These drugs are not newly discovered active agents and therefore should be more easily adopted by doctors without requiring a door-to-door marketing blitz, says Jonathan Ashoff, Senior Vice President of Equity Research with Breen Murray Carrot & Company. Posen's strategy has been to partner with Big Pharma to market its products. For Trexamet, a migraine treatment, Posen signed a deal with GlaxoSmithKline to market the product in the U.S. With Vimovo, a treatment for arthritis, the company partnered with AstraZeneca. Our next article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Investors No Longer Can Rely on Banks Paying Dividends. Stricter federal regulations, cash issues combine to force financial institutions to cut payments. Investors in publicly traded banks in the Triangle region and the rest of the state have seen their returns in the forms of dividends all but evaporate. In the face of continued credit problems and shrinking profits, banks have suspended the payments to preserve capital, either from a heightened sense of prudence or because they're under increased regulatory supervision. In fact, as of December 2010, according to the latest available statewide data, only 15 of 49 publicly traded North Carolina banks were making dividend payments in the fourth quarter of the year, according to data compiled by Bank Street Partners, an Atlanta-based investment banking firm. The bigger banks were the first to either cut or suspend payments during the worst part of the financial crisis. Then the community financial institutions began cutting them back as well, says Bank Street's Lee Burrows. In the immediate region, Raleigh-based Capital Bank suspended quarterly dividends in February 2010, while in neighboring Johnston County, Four Oaks Bank pulled the plug in November. In a recent filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, Four Oaks said it has signed an understanding with state and federal banking regulators under which it has agreed not to pay future dividends on common or preferred stock without prior approval from the SEC. Taking the suspension step in 2009 were an assortment of area lenders, including KS Bank in Smithfield, Yadkin Valley Bank, owner of the Cardinal State franchise in Durham, FNB United, and Randolph Bank and Trust, both in Asheboro. The decision to suspend dividends cuts two ways for publicly traded banks, says Charles Leedy of Chapel Hill Investment Advisors. In the short term, it probably helps since there is a perception that they are trying to preserve cash, Leedy says. But in the longer term, it ends up hurting them with investors who bought for the dividend, and so over time it could hurt the share price. Two Wake County-based lenders, North State Bank of Raleigh and Crescent FinCorp of Cary, historically don't pay cash dividends out of profits, preferring instead to reward shareholders by handing out additional shares through periodic stock splits. Neither has taken that step since 2007. Younger banks struggling to achieve profitability for the first time don't pay dividends in any form. Fuquay Varina's Patriot State Bank, for example, which opened in August 2006 and posted its first profit in early 2010, pays in neither cash nor shares. There are exceptions to the dividend trend. Raleigh-based First Citizens Bank has continued to pay dividends and posted a dividend yield of 0.6% as of the fourth quarter. The dividend yield is the ratio of what a company pays out in dividends each year relative to the price of a share of its own stock. Another way of looking at it is the amount an investor is getting back in dividends for every share of stock he or she owns. Bank of America, currently locked in a dispute with the Federal Reserve over how much the bank will be allowed to increase its dividend payments, was posting a yield of 0.28% as of the fourth quarter. BB&T, meanwhile, had a yield of 2.22%. First Bancorp of Troy posted a yield of 2.41%. None, however, were coming close to Durham-based Mechanics and Farmers. Its dividend yield stood at 12.45% as of the fourth quarter. Asked about the yield, M&F CFO Lynn Hiddle said she couldn't comment because the bank is in a quiet period before its latest financial report is filed with the SEC. And in our remaining minutes, we turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Bank of America veteran to lead Square One. Durham-based venture bank, Square One has tapped longtime Bank of America vet Doug Bowers to be president and CEO of the bank and its holding company. He is replacing bank founder Richard Casey, who died last November. The exhaustive effort undertaken by the board of directors led us to someone with a proven track record in leading top-performing teams, says Square One board chairman Robert Mullenbeck. Doug's broad professional background and obvious leadership skills make him a perfect choice to continue to build on Square One's remarkable success. TBJ reveals 40 under 40 winners. Triangle Business Journal has unveiled the 2011 class of 40 under 40 winners. The 40 under 40 program recognizes outstanding professionals under the age of 40 for their contributions to their organizations and to the community. This year's class will be honored at an awards luncheon May 5 at Northridge Country Club in North Raleigh. Registration for the event will begin at 11:30 a.m. with lunch served at noon and the ceremony itself starting at 12:30 p.m. To see the full list of winners, type this URL in the address line of your browser, bizj.us/b23yb. Psychiatric facility to create 250 Garner jobs. Memphis, Tennessee-based Strategic Behavioral Health LLC has announced plans to open a 72-bed residential psychiatric treatment facility for children and adolescents in Garner's Greenfield Business Park. Strategic Behavioral Health CEO Jim Shaheen was in Garner to announce the company's expansion into Wake County. The $12 million Garner treatment facility is expected to open in the summer of 2012 and will create more than 250 jobs with an average pay of about $50,000 a year. Shaheen says the facility will have at least three facilities.